what I get extremely upset about the medical profession right now is that in spine care, not just spine surgery, in spine care, essentially every treatment we hold out to patients right now has been documented to be ineffective. Right, facet rhizotomies, injections, epidurals, opioids, spine surgery have all been documented to not work. So we know from animal experiments, if you give somebody hope and keep dashing their hopes, they become depressed.
Yep.
And then how many times can you have something held out to you and have your hopes dashed and keep going on?
This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, July 18th. This week, I've got a real treat for you. I have spine surgeon, author, Dr. David Hanscom out of Seattle, practice of the Swedish Institute here in Seattle. And we sat down for about an hour and we talked all about the mind-body connection and the root causes of major health problems and the probability that spine surgery will work for people. I took some questions that I had asked in a couple of the Facebook pages. Dr. Hanscom really opens up quite a bit about some of his challenges, his struggles, the litany of symptoms that he went through throughout his life. It's really a pretty amazing story. And it's to me, one of the more anticipated ones of any of these episodes that I've done. It's the 25th one. And it's something where we get pretty darn personal, and we talk a lot about, some of the challenges that people face when they come through this stuff, and really what the ultimate, the ultimate cause of a lot of this stuff is this really hypersensitive, hyper-irritated nervous system. And it's been pretty amazing for me. I had read his book, and then he re-released it, or he did a second version of his book, which I'm working through now, looking at some of the changes. And a lot of people, when I said that I was going to interview Dr. Hanscom there, I think that maybe there was a little bit of concern because, this guy's a spine surgeon, and some of the thoughts in his first book, it doesn't align with everything that Dr. Sarno has ever said, meaning that the back surgery never works, and which Dr. Sarno never said that, by the way, but that in the majority of cases, I think that some people just thought that maybe Dr. Hanscom was a little bit more pro-surgery and pro-Western medicine than maybe they would want. And I asked him, if you could go back and change what you wrote in the first book, what would you do? And he pointed out that the second one was released in 2016, and him talking a lot about neuroscience and neuroplasticity of the brain and how things change, neural pathways and things like that. There's a couple different camps in the way that I see this stuff. There's either the Dr. Sarno camp, which is repressed unconscious emotions lead to oxygen deprivation in the nerve tissue, muscle tissue, and tendon tissue in people. And then there's more of the neural pathway side, which I see as more like Dr. Schubiner, Christy Weepy, who was on the show about a month ago, talked about it. Alan Gordon, some of the guys that fall into this, Dr. Schechter falls into this category, but they talk a lot more about neural pathways and that these neural pathways get entrenched in our brain. And so you're just looping this message of pain, 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 or anxiety, 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 over and over again. And though these pathways are permanent, just like you learn how to ride a bike, that is permanent. It's not as much to me, at least the way that I interpreted this conversation, it's not as much to me about unlearning, but building more pathways. And I love Dr. Hanscom talks about pain pathways are learned, and but essentially you can divert the fork in the road, and you can have what's called play pathways. And something that he talked about in this podcast that was very similar to something that Steve Ozanich talked about when he was on the podcast in January is this idea of taking, I'd asked him, like, what are some things that you would do or that people can do consciously to help them with getting out of the syndrome? Because there's so much talk about, by doing things to get well, or by doing things to heal, you're being counterproductive. But Steve Ozanich does say that breathing techniques are one, which Dr. Hanscom did not talk about that. But Steve Ozanich did talk about giving some effort into the arts. So it could be painting, could be dancing. I talk about podcasting, right? Like, for me, that's a big component of the arts. So those are some things that Dr. Hanscom talked about as well, is leveraging the arts as a component of healing. So Hanscom's a really big believer in journaling, so expressive writing. My favorite quote in this comes when he talks about how many cases of chronic back pain were solved with surgery, or at least studies that were done, versus how many people were relieved of chronic pain with expressive writing. It's really an amazing talk about all these things. So without further ado, here's Dr. David Hanscom. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, here from the beautiful Washington Athletic Club with Dr. David Hanscom.
Thanks, Eddie. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, first of all, you've become kind of a celebrity in the chronic pain community over the last month and a half, especially.
I'm not sure about being a celebrity, but I'm somebody who survived chronic pain. Mm-hmm. And I think you've read in my book that I, at age 38 years old, just flat out went into chronic pain out of the blue.
Yep.
Doing just fine. All of a sudden, bam, I fell off this cliff. And for 15 years, I was absolutely miserable, no hope. And I had no idea what happened, how I got into it. I had no idea how I came out of it. And I'm a physician, high-level orthopedic surgeon, so I sought every medical treatment you can imagine. And so I probably saw 15, 20 doctors, different medications, all sorts of diagnostic testing. Of course, they could find nothing.
Yep.
So in retrospect, my chronic pain probably started when I was 5 years old with migraine headaches.
Mm-hmm.
And then it developed into 16 different symptoms at the same time. And at the worst part of my deal, around 1999, I was completely miserable, no hope, didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And I was pretty lost. It was a pretty bad ordeal. So it's very gratifying to be able to give it back.
Mm-hmm. So so the cliff story, I'm interested in that. What year approximately?
I was 38 years old.
Okay.
So that was 1988, 1990.
And you were practicing at the time though, right?
Still am. Still was. Yep.
So I guess take us to that. And like, you know, when you think back, and I think many of us like me, for instance, I can say that in 2015, it was my shoulder. And then in 2016, it was my back and my neck. But now having all these months coming out of it for me and back to activity, I can look back to being 5 years old and getting things like chronic nosebleeds and then getting knee pain and then getting stomach problems like all through my childhood. And now I can see like those things are all connected, right? Like especially stomach issues, which probably right. was one of my bigger symptoms for years.
Right.
I'm so curious, like you had, so there's some people wake up and they start having this pain, right? And they don't know where it came from. You had an incident, right?
Well, again, in retrospect, if I look back over my lifetime, every 2 to 5 years, I would add another symptom.
Yep.
So the final deal that put me off the cliff was sort of dramatic, but nothing precipitated it. It was just a cumulative effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually driving across the 520 bridge at 10 o'clock at night. It was 1990. And I was coming onto going from east to west, coming down that ramp. And all of a sudden I started sweating. I felt dizzy. My heart started to race. I started sweating profusely. And I had no idea what was going on. I thought I was having a heart attack, of course. And of course I thought I was going to drive off the road. And it turns out in retrospect, of course, to be a panic attack.
Yeah.
So it's very typical for the first panic attack to occur on a freeway at night.
Oh, wow.
So I'm somebody who's a major spine surgeon. I went to one of the top spine fellowships in the world at the time. And I didn't get there by being a wimp, right?
Right.
And so my mantra was, bring it on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I actually didn't know what anxiety was. I actually was so successful being so busy and so tough. When a patient got admitted to my orthopedic service when I was 28 years old, I actually had to go to the medical textbook and actually look up the word anxiety. So this person had an anxiety disorder. I'm going, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
So I came from a very difficult childhood, and it was crazier than you can imagine, very abusive physically and emotionally. So at age 15 years old, I basically left the house, went to boarding school, and literally shut the door on the rest of my life. And so I decided to move forward and created new David Hanscom, and I did it. I was successful. I was smart. I was athletic. I did all these things you're supposed to do. And now the word would be dissociating from the past. Yep. I just shut the door, moved on. The problem is those core patterns of reactivity are programmed deeply in your nervous system. And so you can suppress them for a while. But as you know, when you try not to think about something, you think about it more. So what I didn't realize is that I was suppressing anxiety at a level I never realized. my entire life was anxiety. I had probably a psychotic abusive mother. I mean, she's probably psychotic. She's very abusive. So anxiety was just normal. That's the way life was, mm-hmm. right? Lots of anger, lots of rage. So again, that was normal. But something told me at age 15, this wasn't quite right. So I just moved forward. So I just left all that stuff behind. But in retrospect, I had migraine headaches when I was 5. Then I did heavy construction work, some back pain. But then my ears started to ring. My feet started to burn. Then I wasn't sleeping very well. Then what happened is that when you suppress anxiety, you may not consciously feel it, but your body chemistry goes through the ceiling. So what I didn't realize, my body is full of adrenaline, cortisol, histamines, and endorphins. Since every organ system is now bathed in a adverse chemical environment, each organ generates its own symptom. So there's over 30 symptoms of an adrenalized, stressed out nervous system.
What are some of the other ones? You listed off just a few that you had.
Right.
The 30 symptoms I'm very curious about, because I had thought when I first started looking into Sarno's work that it's back and neck, knees, elbows, joints, basically.
Right.
But then I read Steve Ozanich's amazing book, and at the end of it, he gives, I mean, it's pages and pages, and it's probably the 30 symptoms, right? So what are some of the other ones that people commonly get that maybe they overlook and they don't think have anything to do with this stuff?
Well, this is my 16 to start. I won't get all of them, but ringing in the ears, tinnitus. And I went to every ENT doctor in the world to try to get my ears fixed. But when you're full of adrenaline, it increases the conduction of the nerves. So when you double the nerve conduction, it increases the pain, but you start developing physical symptoms that you wouldn't ordinarily have. Then my feet started to burn. People have burning around their mouth, different parts of the body. Sometimes people feel cold water running down their back, all sorts of migratory stuff. I developed tendonitis, tennis elbow, Achilles tendonitis, plantar fasciitis. Because again, when you're under a constant adrenaline cortisol assault, your inflammatory tissue, the inflammation changes, and you get tendonitis. I had migraine headaches since I was 5. I had extreme migraines every 2 to 3 weeks my entire life. But what happens, adrenaline shuts down the blood supply to the brain, then you relax just a little bit, the blood vessels expand, and then bam, you have this screaming migraine. I had insomnia, couldn't sleep, and I developed extreme anxiety. And what happened, anxiety finally broke through, and I actually went to counseling for over 13 years to try to solve this anxiety. So I was open to change, I was doing the right things, and I went to counseling in medical school to try to deal with my past. Then the anxiety hit. I started going to counseling every week for 13 solid years. What I didn't realize until maybe 2 years ago, that anxiety is not primarily a psychological problem. It's a chemical reaction to the environment. Every living creature has anxiety in order to survive. So whether it's a fish or a tadpole or a lion or a monkey, every animal has some response that when they're threatened, they take evasive action. So they're threatened by something, they develop their own chemical reaction, they take evasive action, problem solved, then they go back to relaxing and doing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Humans do the same thing. If you're physically threatened, your body secretes a chemical response that tightens your muscles, increases the blood flow, and then you take evasive action, anxiety is solved. Humans have a major problem is that thoughts do the same thing. So your thoughts create the same chemical reaction, and you have this massive chemical response. So that feeling generated by this chemical response is what we call anxiety. So anxiety is a result of this neurochemical input. So physical threat can cause anxiety. Mental threat can cause anxiety. But humans have a problem is that these thoughts, you can't escape your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So you either can suppress them, mask them, or experience them. And as you get older, anxiety tends to get older because these pathways become stronger and stronger. So the reason why I developed all these symptoms is that I was extremely successful in suppressing anxiety. That's what I did. I think that's what a lot of people do. And I was good at it. I mean, my attitude was the opposite, you know, just bring it on.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I became a major spine surgeon by having that attitude. But my body kept having more and more symptoms. So pretty soon I couldn't sleep, another symptom. I started having stomach issues. And again, adrenaline shuts down the blood supply to the stomach. It shuts down the blood supply to the bladder, so you get what's called interstitial nephritis or spastic bladder. I had neck pain, back pain, chest pain, again, severe. And other symptoms include obsessive thought patterns, PTSD, fibromyalgia. I had extreme PTSD. Never had a good dream in my entire life. Everyone was a nightmare. So the symptoms go on and on and on. So the burning in my feet became extreme. These obsessive thought patterns became extreme. And I actually evolved in what's called an obsessive compulsive disorder, which is an extreme anxiety disorder where the thoughts start to become visual. And they're called intrusive thoughts. They're very unpleasant. And of course, the more you try to fight them, the worse it gets. Mm-hmm. So I went to counseling. I talked about it, et cetera, et cetera. The reason why it's so critical to understand that anxiety is not primarily psychological is that it's part of the unconscious brain. It's a basic survival reflex that every one of us hates, so we'll do anything to avoid anxiety. So the unconscious survival response is about a million times stronger than the conscious brain.
Wow.
So if you want to talk about it, first of all, it's a 1-to-1 ratio. Second of all, we now know the brain is very neuroplastic. Your brain's changing every second. Just this conversation, mm-hmm. if any concepts have changed, your brain's actually changed connections. So in medical school, we thought you had a certain number of brain cells that you could only lose. We didn't realize how dynamic that the brain really was. So you can't control your unconscious survival response. If you want to talk about it, where's your attention?
Right.
So it's on the thoughts that are creating the anxiety. So you actually, as you talk about it in counseling, which I'm in favor of counseling in its place, but if you treat this as primary psychological issue, which I did, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Anxiety is this massive neurochemical response to the environment that's a million times stronger than the conscious brain. And I think it's really critical that medicine has not figured this out. I think it's really critical that medicine figures this out pretty quickly, because right now you have this relentless anxiety because you can't escape your thoughts. We now know, for whatever reasons, that adolescents have an 800% increase in chronic pain over 10 years. A massive increase in chronic pain amongst adolescents. Huge anxiety issues. So as we keep talking about it and medicating it, we're actually not solving the problem. In fact, it's getting worse. Then I think, as you know from my book, that remember the antidote is to anxiety is control.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Something causes anxiety. You control the situation to remain safe, and then problem solved. When you don't have control, your body secretes more adrenaline, more cortisol, more stress hormones, and then you become angry.
But where does the control come from?
Well, all of us, if you're threatening me right now, I'm just going to take off or somehow defend myself, and or we try to control people's behavior. In other words, in marriages and stuff like that, there's a lot of control issues, right? Mm-hmm. So you do something that makes me upset, I'll either leave, that's controlling my behavior, or I'll try to control yours, right? So when people say, well, he or she has control issues, I sort of laugh because now I laugh. I didn't laugh then. But everybody has control issues. That's how you survive,
yeah.
Right? So you control yourself or the situation to solve the problem. Again, you can't control your thoughts, but when you can't control the situation or your thoughts, your body kicks in more chemistry and become angry. And obviously, our society right now is very anxious. Lots of mental health issues, bipolar, anxiety, OCD, depression, etc. And then we lose control of that and we become angry. And a lot of behavior right now is extremely angry, destructive behavior. We're not nice to each other like we could be.
Right.
So we know better. But if you're in a survival reaction, remember, it's a 1-to-1 ratio. So knowing better is a conscious action that just gets wiped out by anxiety and anger.
Mm-hmm.
Wipes it out. So you have to, I mean, there's a solution to it. So once you understand the problem, you can solve it. But right now we're treating anxiety primarily as a psychological issue, and it's simply not.
Yep. And people get put on the medication and right. All that kind of stuff. So what does it do, like, biologically? Somebody has anxiety, they get prescribed Prozac or whatever it is that people with anxiety get prescribed, right. And they take it.
Right.
What's happening?
So we find out that in the cascade, you have sensory input that goes into the nervous system. The nervous system is competing for all these senses at the same time. You have a net chemical output that's either relaxed or stressed. And so relaxation means relaxation hormones. Anxiety means stress hormones. So what the medications do, they actually decrease the stress hormone response.
Mm-hmm.
So it works. So it turns out it depends which part of the cascade you're working on. For instance, cognitive behavioral therapy changes the thoughts. mindfulness changes the sensory input. In other words, you go from racing thoughts to just feeling the back of your chair, listening to sounds. So it turns out that active meditation, which is an abbreviated mindfulness, simply switches sensory input.
And that's a lot of this. That's like Schubiner theory. He talks a lot about meditation. Your website, one of the things that I, so I'm like a writer, like I love writing. I did newspaper. I have a minor in journalism. And you talk about writing being a really big piece of this.
Right.
And so what should people be, you know, Sarno's third book, he talked about, it was the first time where really he had given an anecdote. Here's what you should do. And he had talked about, he didn't say journaling, but it was write out the things that are bothering you in your life and basically get it out on paper. That was the idea. And then Nicole Sachs has kind of refined this over time with something that she calls journal speak, where her idea is put everything down on paper and then burn it, get rid of it. There's no need to keep it. It's just essentially getting it out of your system. And so what's your methodology, your advice on people, you know, there's a lot of journalers out there. And so what should they be doing in their writing?
So it turns out that there's over 1,000 research papers that says journaling works. Mm-hmm. 1,000. There's actually not one paper, by the way, that says spine surgery works for back pain.
And you were a spine surgeon. Yeah. Right.
So after my 15-year tailspin into I call it the abyss. I mean, I had no hope. I had all these physical symptoms. I had incredible extreme anxiety. I had no hope. I happened to pick up a book called Feeling Good by David Burns, and David Burns said to write. So there's a three-column technique where you write down your intrusive thoughts, then you categorize them, then you write down a more reasonable response. And what you're doing in retrospect is called neuroplasticity. You become aware of the automatic reaction, you create a little bit of a space, and then you redirect. So what the writing does, which is always the first step in the process, it doesn't matter what else you do, the only one mandatory necessary step is the writing. So what I think the writing does, again, is my just opinion on this one, but you have an awareness of the thought, you've now separated it, so that separation is now connected with vision and feel. Okay, so your brain knows, okay, so then you've now created an awareness of separation, and then we do a little exercise called the active meditation where mm-hmm. you now redirect. So the first step of the process is the expressive writing, and for some reason, nothing really changes until the writing starts. Now I have the patience in myself, I still write, is that I always have them either burn it, shred it, or destroy it somehow for two reasons. One of them is to write with freedom, so it can be positive or negative. Most of the research, by the way, has been done on negative writing, but it doesn't have to be negative. It can be anything at all. And so to me, the writing process is only separation. The other reason to tear them up is to actually not analyze them.
And not relive them.
Right, because if you're analyzing your thoughts, where's your attention?
Mm-hmm.
So if you think in terms of neuroplasticity, you can't control your nervous system, but you can direct it.
My mom keeps her journals like going back to the 70s. And I always think to myself, I think I've only actually said this to her once, but like, Mom, like you're talking about all this negative stuff in these journals, and you go back and you read them, what's the point? Like,
right.
What's the purpose? I don't know what it is. I don't think she's ever given me a good answer for it.
Well, I mean, one of my pain colleagues who's superb at this process just made a simple observation. If you decide to hold on to your writing, you're simply holding on to your pain.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Because you're just, in fact, one of the bad prognostic factors for chronic pain is actually belonging to a pain support group.
Ooh, I talked all about one of the first episodes I did. I talked about spinehealth.com, and I had said, if you ever want to get out of pain, stay the F off of spinehealth.com and the forums, right? Like, that's what I would, when I was deep in my abyss,
right.
I just wanted to find people that had the same pain that I, and like, people would have their signatures, and it would say, you know, John Smith, L4, L5 fusion, and they, like, they just list all the things that they have, and it's just everybody talking about how miserable everything is.
Right. I mean, I don't know how deep you want to go with this, but there's a book out called How Emotions Are Made by Lisa Feldman Barrett, and she's a neuroscientist out of Northeastern in Boston, and she's a brilliant, brilliant neuroscientist, but she goes into the neuroscience of human consciousness. So it turns out the only reason that chair is a chair is because my brain says it's a chair.
Yeah.
Okay. So what she's pointed out, that concepts get embedded in your brain the same as that chair. So I'm a Republican or a Democrat or whatever, or when your identity becomes your pain, I used to say that thoughts aren't reality. That's not true. In human consciousness, thoughts become embedded in your brain as much as that chair or table does. So you become identified with your pain. That does become your identity. And your brain actually responds to that as much as it responds to that chair.
Yeah.
So it's really a deadly thing to keep repeating the process. And one of the symptoms of chronic pain is actually obsessive thought patterns. And so what happens, you start thinking this over and over and over again, becomes deeply embedded. I call it phantom brain pain, where we know about phantom limb pain, where you amputate a leg or an arm, you still feel the leg or the arm, and you still feel the pain. Same thing with these thought patterns, these obsessive thought patterns, is that you get this identity, I'm this, this, or this, or he or she's this, this, and this, that starts spinning and spinning and spinning and becomes embedded. Mm-hmm. And you can't get rid of it. And again, it's irrational. So if you want to talk about it and analyze it, you're absolutely reinforcing it.
And this is part of you saying, we talked about this off air when we first got together tonight, but one of your first rules, which I think is so, it's the first of anybody in the space that I've heard say this, but that you ask the spouse. So if you have a patient that comes in and they've got a chronic problem and you're diagnosing them with neural pathway pain, TMS, whatever we're going to call it, one of your requests is that the spouse comes in. And that the agreement is between this, that you guys from this day forward will never talk about your pain. And I think you've even done workshops or something where people come and they're in groups, and if somebody talks about it, they're out.
Right.
Zero tolerance.
Yep.
Why is it? Why can't I talk about my pain?
Where's your attention?
On my pain.
So let me ask you a different question. So when you were in pain, between talking about it, did you talk about your pain when you were in pain?
Absolutely.
Then, okay, so between talking about your pain and looking for a cure, mm-hmm. what percent of your conscious brain was actually focused on pain?
I mean, I used to say, like, I would go to work 8 hours a day. I would estimate, and I don't work there anymore, so if my managers are listening, this is going to be okay. There was a time where it was probably 6 hours a day was Googling what's this symptom. It was the first thing I looked at when I woke up in the morning. It was the last thing I looked at before I fell asleep at night.
Right.
It was pretty much all that I talked to my wife about. The only person I didn't really talk about it to was my 2 or 3 year old daughter, because she's got no concept of it, you know, what it is that's going on. But it consumed my life, like, in the worst way possible.
Right. So what's happening to your nervous system? In other words, if you want to become a star football player, mm-hmm. let's say a concert pianist, what are you going to do?
You're gonna focus on that, right?
you'll practice. Concert pianists, I understand, practice 8 to 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and their brain gets embedded with those patterns on the keyboard, right? So I think a concert pianist is just superhuman. I'm just blown away when I watch it.
Yeah.
And you know, how is this humanly possible? So those pathways are really deeply embedded. They're very quick. They're very precise. And pain pathways do the same thing. So the problem we now know from neuroscience research, that these pain circuits become memorized in 6 to 12 months, period. And the problem with pain impulses compared to an athlete or an artist or musician learning a skill is that they come in very fast. It's like a machine gun, right? So you're gonna memorize pain circuits way faster than an athlete or an artist. So we now know that within 6 to 12 months, these pathways become embedded. The current definition of chronic pain is that it is an embedded memory that gets connected with more and more life experiences, and you can't erase the memory. So it's like riding a bicycle. Once you know how to ride a bicycle, how do you actually unlearn how to ride a bicycle?
I don't know if there's a way. I don't think there's a way.
There actually is a way. There's a little thing on the website called the backwards bicycle. And these engineers actually developed a bicycle where you turn the handlebars to the right, the wheel went left,
mm-hmm.
and people couldn't ride it.
Yeah.
So once you actually learn how to ride this backwards bicycle, it actually disrupted the bicycle riding pathways.
It's like how my wife on her MacBook has the setting on the touchpad. We both got MacBooks. The touchpad where for hers, if you scroll down, I think the page goes up, and I'm like, oh, I can't even use it anymore. Right? Get it away from me.
Right. So, but bottom line is, if you know how to ride a bicycle, you always know how to ride a bicycle,
yeah.
right? Once you have a pain set of circuits in your brain, you actually always have those circuits. So you have these permanently embedded circuits in your brain, and the more you try to fix them, where's your attention?
On the
circuits. And so they become more and more embedded. And so if you think about all your conscious energy spent doing this, it becomes deeply embedded. And that's why I call it the abyss, because you're desperate for an escape. You lose complete hope. What I get extremely upset about the medical profession right now is that in spine care, not just spine surgery, in spine care, essentially every treatment we hold out to patients right now has been documented to be ineffective. Right? Facet rhizotomies, injections, epidurals, opioids, spine surgery have all been documented to not work. So we know from animal experiments, if you give somebody hope and keep dashing their hopes, they become depressed.
Yep.
And then how many times can you have something held out to you and have your hopes dashed and keep going on?
I mean, I told you I met with 25 medical professionals, and by the seventh one, it was just sort of like, all right, we'll book another appointment with another person that'll probably tell me that it's not going to work. Or,
right.
You know, that'll say they don't know what it is. Or there was somebody, it was like the third doctor I saw, where he said, his exact quote was, it sounds like it's in your head, and I tend to think that the more that people think about these things, but at the time I wasn't ready, right? And right. It's the same thing where when I would search on like healthgrades.com, right? They've got you can go and look at what a physician or a psychologist or a social worker, whatever, what they're graded. And I was thinking back, you asked me when we first met, how did you find me? And I told that. And then as we're walking up here, I know how I found him was that, or the first time I heard your name. Was when I was searching online, because I'm 20 miles north, I'm Edmonds. I had searched for back doctors, because a lot of the pain was in my thoracic spine. And I was looking for spine doctors. And I was just looking at who had the most ratings in the area. And I came across yours. And what I noticed, and again, I wasn't ready, right? So what I had read were these negative reviews. People would say, I went to see him and my low back was killing me. And he told me to read his book. And he told me to, and it was, and you know, like, and I'm sure you heard that forever, right? Your book came out in 2012, the first time, right?
First edition. Second edition came out about a year and a half ago, and much, much clearer book.
And you probably got negative responses all the time.
Well, I mean, the only one obstacle to healing is simply willingness to... I'm sorry, the one factor that determines healing mm-hmm. is simply willingness to engage. So part of the disease are these obsessive thought patterns, like the doctor's missing something, it's all in my head, this is just nonsense. And so that's an obsessive thought pattern that I can't break. I spend hours and hours arguing with people that, yeah, we can solve your pain, but there's two issues. One of them is that the process actually blocks rational conversation, number one. Second of all, believe it or not, people become addicted to their pain. They don't want to give it up.
Yep.
Does that make sense to you?
Well, I brought it up. I was talking to a friend of mine who has not TMS. So she had spinal muscular atrophy diagnosed, you know, as an infant, basically. She's in her 20s now. But there was a therapy, because I used to raise money for neuromuscular disease. That was my job before I got into sales. And we were trying to find cures for ALS. We were trying to find them for Duchenne. We were trying to find them for all these different ailments. And end of 2016, there was an SMA therapy that was approved that would not regress the disease, but stop the progression of the disease. And she had applied for it. She's in her 20s. It sounds like they want to do most of it on kids, right? Because they're going to have the better outcome if you can stop it when a kid's 5 versus when they're 30. Because life expectancy for her was not anywhere near where she is now. Aetna recently approved her therapy. So $750,000 they're going to pay for in the first year, and then $350,000 every year after. But she wrote a blog about this a couple nights ago, and she had said that, I hope that she's listening, she had said that for some reason, and she can't put her finger on it, the moment that it got approved and she knew that the disease would stop, and she knew that that a lot of the progressive pain would go away, she started getting anxiety. And she said, I don't know. And I told her, look, like, I said, I've talked to a lot of people that are in, they, you know, they don't have spinal muscular atrophy, but they have a variety of different ailments. And I've heard the phrase, I don't know what I would do without my pain now. And I'm like, I'd know the same thing. I just freed up 16 hours of my day, right? to not think about my pain.
Exactly. Right. So, but pain's powerful,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. So remember, anxiety is a survival response at the deepest level. Nobody wants to feel anxiety. In fact, when I talk to people about, do you want to get rid of your pain or get rid of your anxiety? 90% of people want to get rid of their anxiety.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, anxiety is a problem because it's, so for me personally, I mean, I have bad knees right now. You know, you might notice me limping a little bit. So I have no cartilage in my right knee, none, and very little in my left knee. So by the way, the data still holds true for hip, knee, and shoulder arthritis, that the severity of the pain does not correlate with the severity of the arthritis. It actually correlates with stress.
Interesting.
So I have days where I'm fired up and triggered, these knees hurt like hell, but I don't have the anxiety I used to have around pain, so it's fine. It's just pain.
Yeah.
Which is crippling and intolerable, and I don't know if you had the same experience, but I wasn't used to anxiety. I hate the feeling. It's a survival feeling. So this relentless anxiety is like a branding iron on your brain. It just drives you right into the ground. And by the way, I also figured out that what drives depression is anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because first, the first clue is that everybody with depression has anxiety, but not everybody with anxiety has depression. Second of all, the first sign of depression is you wake up in the morning and can't go back to sleep. So, okay, that's the early sign of depression, but that's anxiety, racing thoughts. Then you can't fall asleep. So again, anxiety, racing thoughts. Then you're not sleeping and you start losing concentration. Right there, you have depression. That's it.
So you've got, I think of it as like a, I don't know if there's five. So there's a series of different steps on your website.
Right.
So sleep, I think, is the first one. Is that right?
Well, here it goes. I mean, here, so chronic pain is curable if you want it.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the people that, I mean, I actually don't. So on my Amazon reviews, I have people, I mean, if you decide to engage in the process, the first thing I've learned is that, do you really want to get rid of your pain? Is that what you want? So I've learned that people don't want to do it. That's it. So those are people that walk out of the office, literally screaming at me. And I understand. I feel badly. I've actually challenged to find a way to break through to people that are thinking like that, because it's part of the disease. Second thing is, this victim thing is a really big deal. So when you're anxious, you're vulnerable. When you're angry, you're powerful, which covers up the feelings of anxiety. So it covers up the conscious feelings of anxiety for a while. But what it's also doing is really cranking up your body's chemistry, so your pain's way worse.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done couples research, is that when you're triggered by your spouse and you become angry or frustrated, the pain predictably goes up every time. Because you, in other words, you've increased the body's chemistry, you double the nerve conduction, so you physically feel the pain more. So it turns out that mental stress is a bigger problem than physical stress, or I'm sorry, a mental threat is a bigger problem than a physical threat, because a mental threat translates into body chemistry changes, which translates into physical symptoms. That's going back to these 30 symptoms we talked about. When you have a sustained adrenaline stress hormone result, you have over 30 symptoms. So you have the physical symptoms, but the input came from mental threat, not physical.
And how come some people get, so like for me, the way that I told you, like when I, now that I can think in retrospect, I probably had symptoms into being a kid, but the way that my progression worked is it literally went, when I felt like it got really bad, it was shoulder, then shoulder was cleared up, and then knee was cleared up, then sciatica cleared up, and then back. And like it, how come one clears up and then one new one comes?
You know, I honestly don't know that. I mean, there's some people who have written books about metaphors, like for instance, you know, when your knees are bad or hurting, that's maybe weak need or leadership skills.
Louise Hay, I think, is kind of, she wrote a book that was similar to that.
And that could be true. It could be metaphors. I mean, who really knows? And then one of the classic symptoms of the adrenalized nervous system, and I don't use the word TMS or mind body anymore, or even MPD. I'm just saying, look, this is a body's response to sustained stress. By the way, I just want to say one thing before I forget. And I've thought this for a long time, but a paper came out this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association from Sweden. They looked at over 900,000 people. They have these huge registries in Sweden. And they made a very strong connection a definitive connection between autoimmune disorders and stress.
There, it's funny you say Sweden, because there was a person who sent me a really nice message Saturday from Sweden that just wanted to let me know that she was a huge fan of my I don't know how she found me, but cool. It's going to be cool. She'll get a little shout out right there.
It's right there. Sustained, because remember, sustained stress, you change body's chemistry, it changes the histamine level, which changes the immune system.
Now, when you say histamine, because I'm a sales guy, I was a communication major, I did public speaking, that was my thing. When I think of histamine, I think of allergies. Is this the same thing? Same
idea? Histamine stimulate the histiocytes, the lymphocytes, they stimulate the different immune system to get fired up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why antihistamines decrease the inflammatory response. So histamines are the body's chemicals, And I'm not an immunologist. I don't remember the sequence that well, but there's about at least 10 different types of immune reactions. There's white cells, red cells, mastocytes, histiocytes. So there's a bunch of different cells that do different parts of the immune system. So, and we also know that, for instance, chronic pain is a bad deal. We know the lifespan of people in chronic pain is actually 7 years less than the average.
Wow.
We know there's two papers now showing that the impact of chronic pain on a person's life is equivalent to terminal cancer. That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'll just rant for a second. And it's frustrating because if I hadn't gone through my own chronic pain ordeal, I wouldn't have gotten it. The abyss that you and I have talked about is as deep as it gets. You're in a dark hole. There's no hope. Then you start getting labeled by your family, your friends, but also labeled by the medical profession that this must be in your head. Well, guess what? All pain is in your head because your brain's interpreting sensory input.
Yep.
So the reason why this chair isn't hot is because my brain says it's not hot, right? So your brain has to take all the sensory input and determine whether it's safe or unsafe and whether it's pain or not pain. So for instance, if you have visual input that's unpleasant, the experiments show that it takes less pain to actually create the pain center be active. In other words, all input counts. So if you're not sleeping, for instance, you're gonna feel pain more than if you're sleeping more.
When I started seeing a psychologist, a cognitive behavioral therapy, and I really hit the jackpot because in Edmonds, which is a 20-minute, you know, it's 20-minute or 20-mile suburb away from Seattle, which is where we're sitting right now, therapists that have a lot of reviews, they don't come very often. And I met a guy, Terry Copeland, who was, when I had reached out to him, he said, "What is it that you want to meet with me about?" And I said, "Stress and anxiety." That was the best way that I could define it. And I didn't even know that it was stress and anxiety yet. I had read Sarno's book 72 hours before, and I thought, okay, like I got to go see somebody and figure out. I go there. He happens to know, because I've talked to a couple psychologists since that they're not necessarily putting the connection of stress to physical symptoms, which I was surprised about. I thought that all of them felt that way.
Most don't.
So this guy, right, jackpot, read his books, knows everything about him. Like, we have this amazing relationship. He's since retired, but, you know, he's 70 years old. I'm 30. We talk like we're brothers, right? Like, it was amazing. So it was cool to see that. But the first thing he asked me when I came in was, how many hours of day do you sleep? And I, at the time, was like, I don't know, five, something like that. And he was like, tomorrow you need to get seven or greater. And I've since left the job that I was at that was, you know, I'd work very early and I would go to bed very late, but and a lot of that stuff was my choice. But I had since looked for jobs after that allowed me to work from home to where I could now sleep. You know, I go to bed at 10 or 9:30 in some cases, and I don't wake up until 6:30 or 7. And it's amazing how much that has helped.
It's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been actually, there's a study out of Turkey. I'm sorry, out of Israel, that showed that, I mean, I used to think that lack of sleep occurred because of pain. It turns out that lack of sleep actually causes chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
They did not find the reverse causation. So lack of sleep induces chronic pain.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you do, so in your plan, it is increase the sleep. You also talk about the having a more positive outlook on life. Talk about that.
That's different than positive thinking.
Yes.
In other words, so the key to this process, by the way, so there's four stages and there's steps in either stage, but the essence of the solution is you want to decrease the body's adrenaline and you want to change reactive pathways. And so what you're doing, you have to learn to be comfortable with uncomfortable sensations.
Mm-hmm.
So if you keep reacting to them and fighting them, your body stays full of adrenaline. So the essence of the solution is to decrease the body's adrenaline, change the circuits. But you also have to train your brain to be comfortable with anxiety.
Yeah.
So you have to be comfortable with uncomfortable sensations. Then as you quit fighting them and actually switch a different direction, which is a positive outlook. Now, what doesn't work, which I'm absolutely against, because I did this, is how I got in trouble in the first place, is positive thinking. Because
mm-hmm.
positive thinking is a way of suppressing negative thinking. It's a 1,000,000-to-1 ratio, and you cannot win this one. So you have to learn to be able to take the hit, feel uncomfortable, and then you get off, then you just simply switch directions. So for instance, you know, pain pathways are permanent, but so are play pathways. It's also how the brain develops, is through play. So a huge part of human consciousness is around play pathways. And people in chronic pain, particularly families in chronic pain, don't play so much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So again, pain pathways are permanent. You can't solve them. You can create new pathways around them with repetition. But the most powerful way out of pain pathways are play. It's huge.
Give me an example of play.
Well, there's a book out called Play by Stuart Brown. He talks about different types of play. It's not just an obsessive play to distract yourself. So it depends what you want. So some people love writing. Some people love art. Some people love just recreation. Some people are adventurers. Some people are creators.
Podcasters.
Some people are organizers. So it's generally it's terms like creativity, curiosity, gratitude, et cetera, et cetera. And again, as you know, when you're in chronic pain, so it's fascinating. I put on a workshop. I put on maybe 7 or 8 of these now. And we just did a workshop last week at the Omega Institute in New York. We had 17 people in the group. And in 3 days, the entire group shifted.
Wow.
Out of pain.
Wow.
So it's based on awareness, hope, forgiveness, and play. So it's put on by myself, who does some didactic work. My wife's a professional tap dancer. So we do things like the cup song, juggling scarves, just crazy stuff.
Yeah.
But we're doing it in a structured environment that's shared, and people cannot talk about their pain. So I start teasing them about halfway through the process because they get really comfortable not talking about their pain. Mm-hmm. So they're in a structured environment. They're sharing enjoyable experiences together. And again, one of the problems with chronic pain is you become very socially isolated. So they're sharing these experiences. That my daughter is the third person. She's a somatic psychologist. So she has been doing relaxation exercises, drawing pictures, lots of sharing, and they feel safe. Because remember, in chronic pain, you don't feel safe because your body's attacking itself.
Yeah.
So they're in a shared environment that's structured, and again, it's based on awareness, hope, forgiveness, and play. And I tell them, say, look, on Sunday at noon, when they get to leave, I say, look, you're going back to your environment, you're going back to your triggers, and you're going back to your pain. But your brain has tasted it now.
And that's where it'll go.
So the bunch of tools, but you know, we talked about there's a bunch of, by the way, the website is the action plan. It's called backincontrol.com. And what happens is that you just become better at it. In other words, you'll always be triggered. You always go back into pain. There's no such thing as a pain-free existence. But what happens, you get triggered less often. You don't stay in the hole nearly as long.
Yeah, the attacks are way shorter.
Right, way shorter. And then the thing is, is sobering to me is that my entire life until I was 38 years old was suppressed anxiety and anger. That was normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was having all these physical symptoms without a clue to being angry or frustrated. To me, I was a perfectionist, which means I, quote, had high standards. But perfectionism is actually the ultimate anger, right?
Because if you're anything less than 10 out of 10, you're mad.
Right.
Yeah.
So remember, there's a genealogy of anger is that you have a circumstance that you blame, then you're a victim, and then you're angry. Okay? So what happens is that you are never perfect. So you can always blame a situation yourself for being less than perfect. You're a victim of less than perfect, and you're always frustrated. So David Burns, in his book, Feeling Good, points out really clearly that the delta or the difference between your concept of perfect in reality is how unhappy you are.
So what's your advice for people that are in, you know, high stress jobs? We got salespeople, we got real estate agents. I mean, I'm not saying that other jobs are not stressful, but jobs that are traditionally of stress, right? Like, what can they do to mitigate? And if they have these problems now, to mitigate the issue without quitting their job and changing professions?
Right. So what people think is that, remember, there's a website poster wrote called The Eye of the Storm. And basically the metaphor is that the wind represents your circumstances or your racing thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically can't control a hurricane. You can't control your racing thoughts, and you can't control most of your circumstances. So it turns out that stress isn't the problem, right?
Yeah.
It's the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what CBT does, cognitive behavioral therapy does, is you look at the maladaptive thought pattern and you look at your response and then you substitute. So it turns out that when you're under a lot of stress, it's actually your opportunity to practice the tools. So right now, I would estimate I'm probably under at least 3 times the stress I was under 20 years ago when I broke, and I'm fine.
Yeah.
I get physically tired, but I don't get very emotionally tired anymore, because what happens is that, remember, chronic pain is unsolvable. These pathways are permanent. So when you quit trying to solve something that's unsolvable, guess how much energy you have? A lot.
Yeah.
Or like you just pointed out really clearly, which I thought was interesting, is that you now have 6 hours a day more actually to create your life.
16 hours more per day.
Really?
Yeah. Well, wow. You got to take away the 8 hours of sleep I'm now getting.
Yeah, you're right. So, yeah, I mean, it's incredible. Because what you're doing, again, your brain changes by the second. And so when you quit fighting something that's not solvable, I call it solving the unsolvable, you create a little bit of a space, and then you start creating good food, good wine, good friends. And by the way, the symptoms of social isolation are the same symptoms as chronic pain. Mm-hmm. Being with other people is a very strong need. There's an insurance industry review by Cigna done last month, by the way, that shows that 53% of Americans are socially isolated. So when you're socially isolated, you develop the exact same symptoms as chronic pain.
It's funny that you say that, too. There's so many, like, it's as if you and I talked a month ago, and then I went and had all these conversations with people that remind me of things that you're saying. I have a couple of buddies that I texted last week who are way older than me, and I'm joking because they're listening. But they're friends of mine, and I told them, like, hey, guys, so I may not be at the gym that I go to in a little while. Like, I'm just, you know, I like working on the garage by myself, that kind of thing. But I also work remotely from home, so I'm not around. You know, I see my family, right? Like, that's about it. And some of the neighbors and stuff like that. So I was like, guys, we got to go out like once a week and go get beers together, play darts, play pool, something. I'm like, because I don't want to be the socially awkward guy that works from home and then doesn't know how to interact with people. But you're saying there's greater merit to it than just that.
Oh, way more.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to remember the way human consciousness formed is by talking to other people.
Yep.
Right? Okay. So for a human, even animals that don't have language have a need to be around each other. So the species who survived from an evolution standpoint are the ones that could get along with each other and they could help each other out. And so this need for social connection is really right behind air, food, and water. Mm-hmm. It's right there. And I remember my own circumstance is that I'm a social guy. And when I was in the worst part of my chronic pain for probably 5 years, I thought that the loneliness in chronic pain was just brutal. Saying the word loneliness and isolated for me personally is like PTSD. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was horrible being socially isolated. And then it was odd because the more isolated you get, you start getting these really weird thought patterns about your own self-esteem, people don't want to be around me. Mm-hmm. And I have wonderful friends. I mean, they would not abandon me for anything, but your thinking gets distorted. I honestly thought nobody wanted to hang out with me.
Yeah.
So you get this self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So it's a really strange spot to get into with this social isolation thing.
Because you stop calling people and you assume right. That they just don't like you.
Right. Yeah, your brain does really strange stuff. So I have one woman who had been in a wheelchair for 10 years. And she had had some injuries and some workers' comp issues and a divorce. And so she came into me for chronic pain treatment. And I go, well, I'm not doing surgery. And I gave her my book, and she was sort of unhappy with me. And I sent her to my pain specialist friend, and she was unhappy with him, and she quit doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
So I go, okay, fine, whatever. And she's actually in a wheelchair. So she comes on my schedule again. I'm sort of dreading seeing her walk in and going, okay, whatever. And I walk in the room, no pain medications, no wheelchair, no pain.
What happened?
Forgiveness.
For who?
Everybody. Wow. She realized that she'd been sitting in her apartment for 10 years, obsessing about everything that had gone wrong with her.
Yep.
And so somehow over 6 or 8 months, combination of my book, taking some anger management classes, and there's a book on my website written by Dr. Luskin out of Stanford called Forgive for Good, and she figured it out. And I still see her 4 years later. She's around town. She's back doing normal things.
Now, is it like AA where, you know, one of the steps is like you go to the person that you wrong, but in this case, you think that they wronged you? Or is it just really in your own brain, like saying, I forgive this situation or I forgive that person? Or do you have to go to them for what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I'd love to talk about the anger forgiveness as a separate podcast because there's lots of layers to it. But Dr. Luskin's a friend of mine who wrote the book out of Stanford. And basically, forgiveness is a very selfish process because you're simply saying, I'm taking my life back. Mm-hmm. So if you do something that's wrong, if you wrong me somehow, let's say a business deal or something, I mean, how long do I want to hold on to this? So I don't like you anymore, okay?
Yeah.
but I keep thinking about you over and over and over again. So you're in my brain. And Dr. Luskin points out that I'm renting too much of my brain out to you. You're taking too much space.
My wife says that all the time. Like, why are you giving this thing so much attention?
Right. So the person you dislike now has control of your life. So it's a very strong statement of just saying, I'm going to take my life back. And he also points out it's a process. So every time I think of you and I don't like you, I like you, by the way. But I'm just saying that, let's say I don't like you. So his point is that forgiveness is a process, that every time you think of this person or situation that wronged you, you're going to have the reaction. You don't want to suppress the reaction. Remember, the key to this process is being comfortable with uncomfortable sensations. So you don't want to suppress thoughts. You don't want to suppress anxiety. You don't want to express anger. And that's where you do the writing exercises. You separate, you drop your shoulders down, and you just train your brain to let go.
So here's it's a very simple example, but it's something that happens to me personally a lot. Is like my kid is playing outside in front of our house. We live in an amazing community. Nice cul-de-sac. There's like 15 kids that live there. There's a couple of kids sometimes that I feel like, you know, maybe mistreat my daughter, and they mistreat her toys, and like it amps me up, right? And like my wife will usually...
How old is she?
My daughter, she's 4. Okay. So usually my wife will be like, you know, they're just kids or whatever. Like, you know, why do you care so much? I get, for whatever reason, it just, you know, like I see them take one of her toys and stomp on it or something like that. And I just get so amped up. And I'll go inside and I'll think about it for a couple days and I'll talk about it on this podcast and stuff like that. Like, I guess what's the I don't know about the right reaction. What's the better reaction?
So... there's one book that if you have a choice of reading my book or reading this book, I'll just say read this book. I'm serious.
Okay.
It's called Parent Effectiveness Training.
Yeah.
It was written in the 1980s by a child psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Thomas Gordon. And I read the book at least 20 times. And so it takes the parent label off of parenting. It takes the kid label off of being a kid. And it goes human to human. And it's such a clear book. And so you start to listen. And so you take off the response. So it's not about permissive parenting. It's about very clear communication. And I read it when my son was 2. And I never, ever once had officially disciplined him.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about communication. And when things started going poorly, I would reread the book. And it was usually me trying to be too intrusive or trying to control. So these are tricky things as far as the situation, but what happens is you start really developing this true relationship with your kid, his or her behavior will change. And what you're going to find out, which is fascinating, is that kid's behavior towards her will change.
Interesting. Just by interacting with Zoe differently.
Right. But when I'm talking to parents of kids and parenting, so in the family situation, couples always trigger each other.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, not in my world.
My wife and I trigger each other. Yeah. I've not seen one exception. So maybe you don't trigger each other, but I would challenge you. So I'm just saying 100%.
Yeah.
We can go a long time on this one. But I mean, like, for instance, I didn't realize this until about a year ago, is that one thing that triggers couples a lot is the dishwasher. How you load the dishwasher.
Oh, believe
me. And for me, it's the kitchen
me.
Cabinet, right? So I don't close the kitchen cabinet doors. It pisses my wife off.
I don't either. That's awesome.
Right. So what I'm saying, going back to this parenting thing, you're asking me why I'm talking about this whole couple thing,
yeah.
Is that so you're in my office, and I'm going to ask you to come back in 2 weeks with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
And on the website, there's 4 things I ask. I go, number one, you're simply never going to talk about your pain again ever, either one of you, or you're not going to complain. If you have a bad day at work or she has a bad day at work, you get to own it. Not her. It's not her responsibility to calm you down. You get to own 100%. Second thing I ask both halves of the couple to engage with the writing, relaxation, all the stuff on the website. The third thing is I want you to spend time talking about when things were really, really fun. Why are you together? What's mm-hmm. fun? Then the fourth thing is when you get triggered, if you get into an argument, take it outside. In other words, you create an absolute sacred place in your house that's safe. So when you're triggered, the kids know it. They can feel it. Even if you say nothing, the tension's right there.
Mm-hmm.
Take it outside. And so what happens is you go through this parent effectiveness training book. As a couple, you go through this process. It's dramatic what happens to the whole family. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so you'll find within 4 to 6 weeks after you truly start. And the other thing I ask parents to do with their kids is never, ever give them advice, ever.
That's interesting.
Listen.
Yeah.
And that's what this parenting book is all about. It's about listening. And, you know, I mean, if I start giving you, you're asking me for advice now, but if I start giving you advice about some part of your life that I know nothing about, it isn't very well received.
Right.
So my concept of parenting has changed. I mean, lots of parents view themselves as sort of drill sergeants to, imbue a certain amount of values, et cetera, et cetera. And the bottom line is that your role is more like an oak tree. Strong trunk, big branches, protection. And what happens allows your child and your family to feel safe and to be nurtured and to thrive. And so when you watch that, the way to really raise your child better is actually really work on the interaction between you and your wife.
Yeah, I mean, and my wife and I, like when we meet other parents or other kids, we don't want to be judgy or anything, but like how just kind of relaxed and chilled our kids are. And like, people volunteer to babysit them and our kids don't scream at it. You know, they're good kids. But, we meet lots of times where it just kind of seems like kids are on edge. And I do think that that's more of a product of how are the parents interacting.
Right.
Because that's the observation they have, right, is what is it do we see?
Right.
Okay. I promise I'd only keep you for 45. We're at 55 minutes,
okay.
And I've got some listener questions.
Okay.
We can do these rapid fire. You can go into depth, whatever it is you'd like to do. So this comes from Jennifer Curran, and she said she wanted to know, when is spinal surgery needed? Also, can people who have failed spinal surgery, that surgery doesn't take away their pain, still get better and resolve their pain?
So the answer, I'm a spine surgeon. Mm-hmm. I still do lots of spine surgery. But the data shows before we do every surgery, we get people sleeping, relaxed, medication stabilized, exercising. And so we do that for at least 12 weeks before every elective surgery. And so what's happened, I now have over 100 patients with surgical lesions cancel their surgery because the pain disappeared without the surgery.
Is there some kind of percentage or statistic that you...
Well, first of all, I didn't expect this. And so the only time surgery is actually indicated is if you have what's called a structural problem. You can see the pinched nerve and the pain pattern matches. When you do the surgery, the surgery works pretty well, provided just you do all these other things. If you have just back pain, which you can, if you don't know where it's coming from, surgery never works.
Mm-hmm.
So the success rate of a back fusion for back pain is about 25%.
Yeah, which you wrote something fairly recently. You went back and looked at a workers' comp report from like 1993 that talked about the success rate being between 15 and 25%, right? Which you thought that it was astronomically higher before reading that.
Yeah, I came out of my fellowship with I was a zealot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did 9 times the rate of spine surgery in Seattle as any place in the entire country. And I was part of that. So I spent 8 years doing all sorts of spine surgery for back pain. And I was going, this isn't working very well. Then I asked some of my senior partners at the time, well, what's the data? And they go, we don't know. I'm going, really? So then it turns out that every paper since then, I still have not seen one paper over 30 years that says spine surgery works for back pain.
Yeah.
Now, it works for sciatica if you have a matching symptom. But, I mean, lots of people, I mean, you told me your story that you had these arm symptoms. EMG was positive. There's nothing being pinched. Mm-hmm. So how do you think surgery would work on that?
I'm happy I didn't go down the thoracic outlet syndrome.
Right. So if you can't see it, you can't fix it.
What about there was that New England Journal of Medicine study. I feel like maybe it was from 96 or maybe it was earlier than that. But it had taught basically that what they had concluded was 70% of people that had bulges or herniations were pain-free. Meaning like 70% of people walking around may have them. And I remember one doctor was even unwilling to MRI my thoracic because he was like, you probably do have a, but there's no reason to do it because most people will have a herniated or bulge disc. I don't want you to see that and then only think about that.
There's no correlation between disc bulges, disc ruptures, arthritis, and pain.
Amazing.
It's just not there. So amazing. Unfortunately, a patient gets told by the doctor you have degenerative disc disease. And I wrote a website post about a month ago saying, look, degenerative disc disease is not a disease. It's just you lose water content. Your mm-hmm. spine becomes stiffer. It has nothing to do with pain.
And it is nothing. What it is.
It just your spine's a little bit stiffer. That's it. And so that's what's really a little frustrating right now in spine surgery is that the data shows that there actually is no correlation. In other words, the research shows, like you pointed out, that most people walking down the street without back pain have degenerated a disc. Mm-hmm. Yet we think by 2020, there's going to be 1 million spine fusions a year in the U.S. alone.
God. We're going to get to one of those questions in a second. So somebody else had asked... Okay, so this person, this is from Barb Marquardt, who was actually the person who had tagged you to say, you gotta talk to Eddie. So she said, I think the fundamental question for him that would help clear up some confusion is, in the time that has passed since he wrote his book, I'm assuming she means the first version, 2012, what changes would the book have if you were to write it today? Also, what is next for him? Are you retiring, or are you going to continue healing in a different way?
Okay, well,
that's a lot of questions. Sorry.
Okay, let me try one time. Okay, so let's work backwards. So
you rewrite the book today.
Okay, so what's changed is that I didn't know the neuroscience on the first book. And so what I now know, anxiety is the pain. I did not know the neurochemical reaction. I did not know anxiety was not primarily psychological. And so the neuroscience research the last 5 years is stunning, just documenting exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. So chronic pain is curable. Three things: understanding the problem, treating every aspect at the same time, patient takes control. This is a curable problem, reliably so. So that's changed dramatically from the first book. Second of all, I didn't understand that people with surgical problems could get better without surgery. So my first book, I said, look, if you have a structural problem that needs surgery, do it now, and then do the chronic pain work later. The research actually shows when you do surgery in the presence of chronic pain, you can make the pain worse 40 to 60% of the time. So if you address the variables we talked about, like sleep, stress, etc., we probably have over a 90% success rate. If somebody does not want to participate in calming things down, I won't do the surgery anymore. Why would I cut your surgical rate in half? So that's changed dramatically since the first book.
It always makes me think about, like, if you had... Tiger Woods has had 7 or 8 spine surgeries that never work. Steve Kerr has had 3 or 4 surgeries that have not worked. Like, what's actually going on with them?
Well, I actually have to not comment on that, because I honestly don't know.
In other words,
every situation is so different. So I would just estimate in general, probably 70% of spine surgeries should not be performed.
Damn.
At least.
Well, okay. Well, so... couple of the other questions here. Oh, so this comes from Matthew Rossett. He actually, he moderates one of the TMS groups that I'm a part of, but he says, please thank him for his valuable contributions to the world and mind body work. It is hard to argue with a guy who both had back surgery and performed back surgery. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. No,
and it's cool that you're right in my backyard too.
Well, I mean, my experience was, I mean, people look at me now because I'm having a great time. I have a great career, great practice, people getting better. So I could not have a more rewarding, enjoyable life as I have right now. So people don't understand that I was in this pit for 15 solid years, mm-hmm. really badly, and I'm fine. And so I'm my own story of hope, and so it's incredibly rewarding to be able to give some of this back to literally hundreds of patients now that I've gone to pain-free.
Yeah.
Incredibly rewarding. So, yeah, I'm excited.
The last one is, this is one that I'd thought about for a long time. I'm curious about the validity of trigger points.
Well, they're real.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you push in again, remember we talked about how the chronic stress cranks up the body's chemistry?
Yep.
So you get an inflammatory response. Remember, mental threats translate into changes in body chemistry that creates a hypersensitive inflammatory response.
So if you unwind that, trigger points can go away.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not just by...
But you also remember it's always... Let me just back way up in the conversation. So it turns out that chronic pain is curable... So it turns out that everything works in chronic pain a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But sleep might be 20%. Trigger point injections could be 15%. Chiropractic could be 15%. So it's always an additive process. In other words, nothing works by itself, but it's always a combination of things that work. So, for instance, trigger point injections can be fair game for sure. Medications can work for a while. And so it's always a combination of things that actually solves the problem.
Do you think that a lot of that stuff, like trigger point injections and medications and chiropractor visits and stuff like that, like, could that maybe be fueling the belief? Like you believe this chiropractor is fixing the problem.
So that's what's fascinating about this process. So let's say you're in my office for the first time and you're one of those people who wants to say, well, Dr. Hanscom is just sort of full of it because this is just a crazy book, whatever it is. So this is not about belief. This is about connecting with reality. In other words, this is connected and engaged thinking. So if you want to go home and start writing the piece of paper, you know, Dr. Hanscom is just out of his mind, which my wife sent things sometimes, a lot of the time. But I mean, honestly, it's sort of a little bit crazy for me right now. So, okay, you're coming to me for major spine surgery consult, and I'm telling you to go home and write. So part of it, patients feel invalidated because this is so simple and I have such a big problem. I get it. So I don't understand why the writing works. It's still the one necessary step. And so you don't have to believe it. You just have to do it. And so that's what's odd. It's like people say, well, it's like a rah-rah belief system. I'm going to feel better. Absolutely not true.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, as you just connect with what is, like the anger, the frustration, the anxiety, you actually start training your brain to actually be with it. Again, remember, anxiety is just a sensation generated by the body's chemistry. As you start training your brain actually to calm down, whether you believe me or not, you feel better.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Actually, the belief part of it is actually a negative, not a positive.
Gotcha. Because it would be in the same arena as positive thinking.
Right.
Same idea. Okay. We're at 1:05. We're officially 20 minutes over. I thank you so much.
Yeah. I love the conversation. Obviously, for me personally, it's really enjoyable to talk to somebody who knows a lot about the topic. Mm-hmm. So I have to explain everything all over again. But I'd like to, at some point, if it's appropriate, these family issues have just been unbelievable. It affects the bullying part of things. It affects the kids' performance in school.
Mm-hmm.
I think you might have read about that there's actually a there's a reward for bullying, that people that are bullies have lower inflammatory markers than the average population.
I wonder.
So the whole family thing goes right into the school system, goes right into your kids. And these family dynamics are powerful. So I can do all these medical treatments, writing relaxation, trigger points, whatever it is. The family dynamic wipes it out.
Yeah.
Conversely, if you understand that, the family dynamic absolutely is unbelievably powerful reverse in the process. It's huge.
Yeah.
So, I'd love, at some point, if it's appropriate, I'd love to talk about this at some point, because that's become the biggest paradigm shift I've had in the last year.
I could talk about all this stuff for... We could be here till tomorrow. I don't know how late this place is open, but I could be here the rest of the night. So people can find you backincontrol.com.
Correct.
Right? And they can find your book on Amazon. It's actually got great reviews. Just like what I said about health grades earlier, the Amazon reviews are fantastic for it. And then is there anything else I'm thinking of?
It's on Audible. Okay. A lot of people love Audible book is actually selling really well. My wife actually self-published the book, and it took her like 6 months to find this reader who I said, look, just get somebody. But she really did a great job finding a wonderful person to do the Audible book.
It does make a difference. Have you ever heard of the book Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers?
I've not read it, but I've heard of it.
So it's very much in the... my psychologist told me to read it, but it's the cortisol adrenaline response and why animals, why they go off into the woods and then they shake and then it's over, right? The Audible guy on that, and I'm not saying that he's a bad dude, but he was the wrong guy to read a book that's that long.
Got it.
It's like a textbook. Cool. Well, again, thank you so much. Hopefully we'll talk again and we'll do this again at some point.
Do it.
Awesome.
Great.
Thank you.